Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who like books. My name is Heather Wardover, and I'm podcasting from my corner of the Sonoran Desert, the Old Pueblo, Tucson, Arizona. Episode 68. Okay, so what's a Morholt? Well, hello, faithful listeners. It is I, your really brain-fried podcaster. This week was stupid week. I don't know any other way to describe it. Everything I tried to do, it seemed not to work. And it seemed to bleed over into everybody else's life, too. I had a lot of just missed connections and things that were supposed to happen that didn't, and blah, blah, blah. The good news is I got a lot of really interesting email this week, including this one that I need to read to you. The date on this is May 12th, 2006. So that's shortly after we began the podcast, like very shortly after we began the podcast. And the email says, "Hi, I like very much to listen to your podcast while knitting and weaving. I looked at LibriVox. What I would like to listen to in the future, Tristan and Isolde by Joseph Bedier. I love medieval legends. Greetings from Switzerland, Helga Jossen." And Helga has a blog, which I will link to. Helga, if you are still listening after I ignored you for so long, please drop me an email. I would love to know if you're still out there. But yes, here we are with Tristan and Isolde. And I love medieval legends too. I'm actually having a lot of fun researching the Tristan and Isolde thing. And I have a number of emails to read to you from people who have brought up interesting things. But before I get to the Tristan stuff, Spider Knit, one of our regular listeners who's read before, tried to record an audio message to all of you. And I think she tried it four or five times, and she'd hit the submit button, and then it would freeze. And we aren't sure what happened, but instead she decided to send me her comment, and I'm going to read it to you. And this goes back to Tale of Two Cities. So I'm going to do Tale of Two Cities stuff first, and then we'll move our way forward into Tristan and Isolde. So, Spider Knit says, "Hi, craft literaries. I've been thinking a lot about the last chapters of Tale of Two Cities, and I wanted to make some comments. I was, like others it seems, quite shocked by Mrs. Pross's killing of Madame Defarge, and one of the things I've been thinking about is how Dickens treated the consequences of that scene. My understanding of the writing of that period, and it is a little sketchy, is that it was always important to have people receive an appropriate consequence for their actions, whether it was a reward or a punishment. I suspect in that frame, that therefore Miss Pross had to have some kind of personal consequence for the murder. It wasn't, after all, completely in self-defense. While it was an understandable defense of her ladybird, I think the deafness was a statement by Dickens that murder always has a price, even when in defense of those you love. Further, what struck me from my comments about Miss Pross's deafness was that I feel that Miss Pross's true punishment is not the loss of her hearing, although that is significant. Her true punishment would be that she is, and will always be, a murderer. Miss Pross was a good Christian Englishwoman, and as such, I think she would recognize that killing Madame Defarge was a sin, and that she would feel the sin heavily. She would not ever regret the action, but the cost to her soul would always stay with her. And the other thing I have been musing over has been the touching kindness of Sidney to the little frightened girl. His giving up of his own life for the happiness of his love was touching, but this kindness to the young woman who he had just met was lovely. There was such a sense of peace in that last chapter, which is so striking considering the backdrop it happened against. I think there was something at work there that I have seen at work before, both in my own life and through things I have seen and read. The most well-known exemplar of this I can think of is the Dalai Lama. Here is someone who always seems at peace with himself and totally accepts the situation he finds himself and Tibet in. However, he maintains a steadfast opposition to China, which is in no way aggressive or violent. This kind of quiet resolve in the face of others' aggression and violence is what I think we see with Sidney. Here is someone at peace with what is happening, who he is, and who he has been. He even has enough grace within himself to share his strength and peace with a girl whose hand he held. It shows how, when we can truly accept ourselves and the situations we find ourselves in, that we can rise above the bad behavior of others and appalling circumstances and remain peaceful within ourselves and for others. Peace, regardless of the people or situation we face. One more comment. I think this really is a novel you have to finish to appreciate. I don't think I would have had such fondness for it if I hadn't heard slash read the whole thing. If you only read the first third, you'd be forgiven for thinking it okay and perhaps rather overrated. Interestingly for me, I felt like this about Wuthering Heights, too. I did in high school what you did to Tale of Two Cities. I read chapters 1 and 2, the last one, and then listened attentively in class, got an A, and reread it a couple of years after and enjoyed it once much more. One final comment. Is it me, or has Tristan a bit of a medieval hottie? He's honest, he's a man's man, he's smart, he's knowledgeable, and courtly. I look forward to hearing it all go horribly, horribly wrong. Oh, and I read, should that be heard, a different take on the Huntsman saying, show us your better way. Maybe it's the modern sensibility, but couldn't you hear the sarcasm? Picture this. Nice, honest guy rides up. Is that how you should be doing it? Huntsman, annoyed. Why? You got a better idea? Tristan, well, proceeds to do it better. Huntsman, oh, yeah, that is better, I guess. Where'd you learn to do that? Etc. See? Not so strange. Or was that just in my mind? Sorry for the long and rambling. Have a great week. So, Spider-Knit, I think, brought up some really interesting points. And I think she probably is dead on with the interpretation of Miss Pross's paying for her actions with the knowledge that even though she didn't regret her action, what she did was in fact a sin. And that puts an interesting spin on the whole concept of right and wrong and good and evil. And it certainly makes Miss Pross into a much more interesting character than you think she's going to be at the beginning of the book. I really appreciated also that Spider-Knit brought in the Dalai Lama, that the image, kind of the overlay, you know, kind of putting the Dalai Lama over Sidney Carton had not crossed my mind, and it really struck me as such a beautiful image. It had me thinking this week. And of course, Tristan is a medieval hottie, and I think somebody needs to get a t-shirt. Now we're going to have another craftlet thing, something about a medieval hottie. So that was from Spider-Knit. Then we have... which was the next one I was going to read to you? Carrie wrote and said, thank you for choosing Tristan. It reminds me of the stories I was told as a child and has distinct echoes of Arthur. And that's something I'm going to talk more about today. But she did check, and Tintagel is pronounced Tintagel. She says, most words in both Cornish and Welsh, and I guess Gaelic, are pronounced with quite hard consonants. My pronunciation of Tintagel is correct. I don't know where the reader is from, but she also mispronounces Burgess's. Again, the G sound is as in jest or jail, not gulp. So the G sound is obviously more commonly a soft G to hear. Funny how the regional variations come out. So I feel vindicated. I pronounced it correctly. And honestly, with no reason for having pronounced it correctly. I did take a class on Arthurian legends at UCLA, but I mean, dear God, that was 20 years ago. I hardly expect to remember how to pronounce everything, and I'm sure I will butcher more as we go along. Then Molly wrote, and she said, I agree about the reaction of the huntsman to Tristan being a bit much. Here's my take on it. In the 12th century, kingship was considered to be both a divine right bestowed by God, to be a divine right bestowed by God, not an accident of birth. Is it possible that even though they don't know that Tristan is royalty, it is implied that he had the divine heir of a king, and that is why they concede to him so quickly? They certainly make mention of how they are surprised a Burgess's son knows such skills. And again, the harper does a similar thing when he asks Tristan to play the harp. Harps were very personal things that musicians did not lend out lightly. And of course, Tristan plays beautifully, not just because of his training, but because he was royalty, and thereby blessed by God. She wrote, what do you think? And I think it's a really good explanation. I think there's a lot of manner, and I don't mean like good manners, like polite, but manner as in customary things that happen in a lot of these old stories. And it's one of the reasons why sometimes they're just completely lost on us. And you're going to have more of that kind of stuff today. But on the crafty side of things, I both have really good news and really lame news. The really good news is someone either emailed me or put a link on one of the two blogs that I can now not track down for a song by a band named Tarkio. And the song is Tristan and Isolde. And they had the song is on their website. It's a free download. And therefore, I am going to go out on a limb and assume that this is public domain. It's a beautiful song, and I, as you know, I don't normally play music on the show, but I actually think that today I'm going to. At first I thought I was just going to put the link up, but not everybody goes to the blog and looks at all the links that I spend ever so much time putting up for you. So I'm going to save you the trouble of going to the blog, although I am still going to put the link up along with a link to the lyrics. This is not a song about Tristan and Isolde in the old days. It's a lovely little modernization, and I thought you might enjoy it. So whoever you are, write me back. Write at mamaoknits.blogspot.com and send me your name so I can attribute it correctly to you. But also, if you have a blog, please send that to me as well, because then I can link your name to your blog. I also, before I forget again, I wanted to thank Sandra for her very generous and kind donation. It couldn't have come at a better time. There is no writing work for me right now, so I am being sustained by the you don't make any money at it adjunct teaching job at the U of A. So it was really very appreciated. So now I am going to play for you Tristan and Isolde by Tarkio.
Would you like to go out tonight? So Tristan to Isolde. It's a lovely night to go to the Odeon. Sit in the back row, sick of staying in. Oh, so they threw on some clothes, walked slowly down the street, lit by lantern light. Through the market square, studied the marquee, bought two tickets and some popcorn. And on the screen, the hero stands with female God, I love you, but you trouble me. She pushes him away. Credits roll, Tristan turned to his own, said, what did you think? It was okay, I guess, that story's pretty old. It's a bit cliche and hackneyed, Back out on the street, they stopped for some ice cream, talking quietly. There was nobody in the room in which they sat, as he reached across the table. And just as their fingers you trouble me. So Tristan to his own. So Tristan to his own.
Wasn't that just a nice, simple song? Ah, man, it's been a long time since I've heard music like that from anyone but the few bands that I still listen to. So that was nice. And leads me to crafty talk, because music is crafty, I guess. I have been working on the Guayabara shirt, the Cuban shirt from the Knit One the Knit One issue, the green one that we interviewed Adina Klein for, and it is progressing at a nice clip, and I have to say, it's quite handsome. I'm very happy with how that's coming along. And I am still poking along on my little I Love Gansey socks. I'm doing, you know, maybe a row here or there or wherever. And I'm back to spinning again, which has turned out to be ever so nice. I really am enjoying it. And then I suddenly got a shock, which is SOAR is early this year, or at least it was earlier than it was last year. It's going to be the first week of October, which means if I'm going to ship my wheel, I have to ship my wheel very soon, and I won't have my wheel for a whole month-ish. And I'm feeling very traumatized by that. So I guess that's one of the reasons why I'm kind of getting spinning in now while I can, doing what I can to make the wheel feel loved. And I've been doing more sketching with my son, whose art curriculum is having him do things like self-portraits and still lifes. So I've been sketching with him, which has been very, very nice. And I'm thinking maybe it's time to go back and take another either drawing or painting class. I think I should probably start with a drawing class. I used to draw quite often. And I used to be freakishly good at drawing hands, which is completely bizarre because hands are actually, from what I've been told, quite difficult to draw. But there's something about hands that just worked for me. So I could draw something that looks like a stick figure, and he will have spectacular hands. So maybe I'll learn how to finally draw the rest of a human body. I don't know. It seems like the thing to do. Turn 40, learn how to draw something other than a hand. But that is what I have been up to lately. I've also been working on an article on something that my local guild did, which was they constructed an entire ranch, like a southwestern ranch, out of handspun. Everything on it except for the base cloth, which is kind of a felted wool. It could be felt anything. It's felted wool. It's not alpaca or anything unique. It's something that they just got at the store. But aside from the base, everything is handspun. They did have to, obviously, create some foundation for pieces like the barn or the houses. They've, you know, had to create something solid that they could slip the knitted or woven piece over. But everything in it is handspun. And trust me when I tell you, it's huge. Not height-wise or dimension-wise, but huge as in, you know those big tables that they use in elementary schools that fold up and down? They're like 8 feet long and, I don't know, 3.5 feet wide. Yeah, this is actually a little bit bigger. They have to put extra tables together. It's enormous. And it was not a particularly large group of people who worked on it. It was the spinning study group. People who have been, you know, actively working on their spinning, who created this thing in under 6 months. They just kind of went nuts and took it to a regional fiber conference, and now it's going to be used for outreach to teach and show people what can be done with fiber. And so I've been able to write about that for the last 2 days, and it's put me in a very fiber-friendly mood. So that has been just an extraordinary amount of fun. And I also have been trying to finish that squid hat for my sister for Halloween, and I am really stuck. I've gone back a few different times, a few different ways, and I have tried to find a way to knit with double strands of acrylic on smallish needles and not hurt myself. And I am unable to do it. I am actually going to have to stop making the knitted squid hat. I can't keep it up. If I could teach someone else in my family to knit and have them take it up, I would. And maybe there's a small chance I can get my mom to. Because I just feel horrible. I mean, it's partway done and it's hysterically funny and it hurts. It just hurts. It hurts my wrists. And I think part of it is radiated pain because I think the force isn't just being taken out on my wrists, but it's because it's a heavy piece on top of being a tightly knit piece. And so it's my shoulders, it's my neck, and it's my wrists, and even eventually my hands. So I don't know, maybe I'll just try and do like a row a day and leave it at that and hope that I can finish it. But if any of you have, you know, techniques for how to deal with something like that, unfortunately, I can't put the whole thing on a circular needle. It's not that kind of problem. It's not like knitting a heavy sweater on straight needles. This is actually a problem that the entire piece is huge and you have to hold some part of it up no matter where you're knitting, because it's everything's kind of grafted. You leave stitches live and then pick them up when you need them and keep going. And some of the picking up and adding stitches too turns out to be really tight and intensive stuff. And while I have actually stopped being such an incredibly tight knitter, like when I knit socks, I'm actually having to knit some socks on 000 needles. They're like piano wire because my sock knitting stitches are very loose. And I've noticed that even with the Guayabara shirt and other things that I'm doing, my stitches have loosened up considerably. I am no longer knitting Kevlar. This thing, however, is constructed to end up as Kevlar because you have to stuff it within an inch of its life. And in the process of doing that, of course, you don't want any holes that the stuffing would fall out of, and therefore I can't knit it. So I am more than happy to accept any help or ideas from anyone. Because I really want to finish it. Anyway, so that's that. I think that's all of the crafty talk for tonight. But we have Tristan and Isolde. And we have two chapters tonight because the first one is really quite short. And one of the things that I had wanted to talk about that I didn't spend much time talking about last time is the overlapping connections between things like Tristan and Isolde and the King Arthur legends and some other Welsh legends that show up in the Lloyd Alexander books, the Terran books, which are based on the, I know I'm going to pronounce it wrong, Mabinogion. Oh, that's so hard. But the Arthurian thing is very interesting because as I've been reading more and more about Tristan and Isolde to kind of prepare for the podcast, one of the things that I came across was the quote-unquote real Tristan. At this point, of course, it's all really just academic because who cares if it was a real guy? He's been dead a really long time. And basically all we have to tell about him is a bunch of stories. However, it is interesting to me that some people think there was this Pictish prince whose name eventually evolved into Dristan. Originally it was Drust, and I'm sure I'm mispronouncing everything. But there are overlapping stories that come from different places. And it's like with the Arthurian stuff. And obviously I know a little bit more about the Arthurian legends than I do about the Tristan stories, but with the Arthurian legends, one of the things that I learned in my class that has stuck with me for 20 years that I found most interesting was that you can tell a lot about stories by other records. So for example, somewhere around, oh geez, I think it was 800 AD or Common Era, depending on how you chart your time, there was some kind of person who impressed everyone in southern England. And the reason they know this is because if you know, are in touch with your history, the Romans had occupied southern England. And in fact, Hadrian built Hadrian's Wall in northern England to keep the crazy Scotsmen, of whom I am a descendant, out. you know, if you saw Braveheart, you saw them paint themselves with woad and get all freaky on their enemies. So Hadrian wanted none of that, and he built the wall, which still stands, which you can still go see. Well, Hadrian was a Roman general, and they left Romans in England for quite some time. And in fact, if you read Neil Gaiman's book, Neverwhere, and you read that, you will find that Neil Gaiman has a very interesting take on where the Romans are. Briefly. It's just a little brief thing, but it was one of those moments where I went, oh, I know why he's making that joke. And it's because the Romans had been camped out in southern England for so long. Well, blah, blah, blah. There were the Celts, who were already there. There were the Picts, who were already there. There were a number of different tribes who were already there. And then there were the Romans. You can imagine that the folks who had started off there didn't much like Roman occupation. And because Latin is a language that we can follow, and because the Romans, not unlike later on the Nazis, were very good at keeping records, we know quite a bit about things that happened back then. Things like sales, things like births, things like marriages. So one of the things that happened around 800 AD was that there were suddenly a bunch of Celtic children being named Artos, which means the bear in Latin, evidently, or at least it did 20 years ago when I was in school. I may be remembering it completely wrong. For a Celtic family to name their child after a Roman name implies that something had happened that made people like that name particularly much. And some of the theory is that there was a warlord whose name was Artos or Arthur, who had been particularly good at keeping all of the sides balanced and happy. I think Marion Zimmer Bradley actually did a pretty good job of dealing with this situation when she wrote The Mists of Avalon. She did a lot of research when she wrote that book, and I found it very heartening that her kind of fictional take on all of the people and the things that happened in her book, it was really based a lot on the research that's out there, at least the research that was out there 20 years ago that I was taught. So it doesn't surprise me a lot that there are people who think that there was a real Tristan. The thing that I think is interesting, and this is one of the pieces that you're going to hear more of tonight, is that there may have been a real Tristan, but who knows what that Tristan was responsible for. He too may have just been a particularly good leader, and people started making up stories about him after his death, because a lot of the stories that you both hear tonight and will hear later show up in other people's stories as well, including Arthur's. So there's this kind of overlapping of heroic tales. That is, of course, what happens with an epic. Each hero has to go through certain trials, and honestly, there are only so many trials we can make them go through. So tonight is a trial story. It's called The Morholt Out of Ireland, and I will again break into the narrative to make sense of it.
Recording by Joy Chan. The Romance of Tristan and Isolde by Joseph Bedier. Translated by H. Belloc. Part the First, The Morholt Out of Ireland. When Tristan came back to that land, King Mark and all his barony were mourning, for the King of Ireland had manned a fleet to ravage Cornwall. Should King Mark refuse, as he had refused these 15 years, to pay a tribute his fathers had paid? Now that year this king had sent to Tintagel, to carry his summons, a giant knight, the Morholt, whose sister he had wed, and whom no man had yet been able to overcome.
Okay, so the Morholt is a really big fighter, and they will keep calling him the Morholt. And I am going to go out on a limb and assume that in Gaelic it probably means something. But, you know, for us, all we can do is say, well, he's a really big fighter and nobody's been able to best him yet. And the reason he's going is because he married the Irish king's sister. All right, here we go back.
So King Mark had summoned all the barons of his land to council by letters sealed. On the day assigned, when the barons were gathered in hall, and when the king had taken his throne, the Morholt said these things: King Mark, hear for the first time the summons of the King of Ireland, my lord. He arraigns you to pay at last that which you have owed so long, and because you have refused it too long already, he bids you give over to me this day 300 youths and 300 maidens, drawn by lot from among the Cornish folk. But if so be that any would prove by trial of combat that the King of Ireland receives this tribute without right, I will take up his wager. Which among you, my Cornish lords, will fight to redeem this land?
Okay, three guesses who's going to fight. But more than that, this is the Irish king is demanding basically, it's kind of like a mafia move. He's having the Cornish people pay to keep the Irish from attacking. And King Mark has not paid. And so now the guy's coming back and saying, yeah, well, you haven't paid for 15 years, so now you owe me. And you owe me big, and you need to send me men and women, young men and women. And who knows for what purpose?
The barons glanced at each other, but all were silent. Then Tristan knelt at the feet of King Mark and said, Lord King, by your leave I will do battle. And in vain would King Mark have turned him from his purpose, thinking, how could even valour save so young a knight? But he threw down his gage to the Morholt, and the Morholt took up the gage. On the appointed day he had himself clad for a great feat of arms, in a hauberk and in a steel helm, and he entered a boat and drew to the islet of St. Samson's, where the knights were to fight each to each alone. Now the Morholt had hoisted to his mast a sail of rich purple, and coming fast to land, he moored his boat on the shore. But Tristan pushed off his own boat adrift with his feet and said, One of us only will go hence alive. One boat will serve. And each rousing the other to the fray, they passed into the isle. No man saw the sharp combat, but thrice the salt sea breeze had wafted, or seemed to waft, a cry of fury to the land, when at last, towards the hour of noon, the purple sails showed far off. The Irish boat appeared from the island shore, and there rose a clamour of, The Morholt! When suddenly, as the boat grew larger on the sight and topped a wave, they saw that Tristan stood on the prow, holding a sword in his hand. He leapt ashore, and as the mothers kissed the steel upon his feet, he cried to the Morholt's men, My lords of Ireland, the Morholt fought well. See here, my sword is broken, and a splinter of it stands fast in his head. Take you that steel, my lords. It is the tribute of Cornwall.
So this piece of sword that is stuck in the Morholt's head, that will come back again. And of course, Tristan is pretty bold by saying, yeah, well, that's all you're going to get, is this piece of steel. No tribute, no money, no 300 women and young men. Pretty harsh.
Then he went up to Tintagel, and as he went, the people he had freed waved green boughs, and rich cloths were hung at the windows. But when Tristan reached the castle with joy, songs and joy bells sounding about him, he drooped in the arms of King Mark, for the blood ran from his wounds. The Morholt's men, they landed in Ireland quite cast down, for whenever he came back into Whitehaven, the Morholt had been wont to take joy in the sight of his clan upon the shore, of the queen his sister, and of his niece Isolde the Fair. Tenderly had they cherished him of old, and had he taken some wound, they healed him, for they were skilled in balms and potions. But now their magic was vain, for he lay dead, and the splinter of the foreign brand yet stood in his skull, till Isolde plucked it out and shut it in a chest. From that day Isolde the Fair knew and hated the name of Tristan of Lyonesse. But over in Tintagel Tristan languished, for there trickled a poisonous blood from his wound. The doctors found that the Morholt had thrust into him a poisoned barb, and as their potions and their theriac could never heal him, they left him in God's hands. So hateful a stench came from his wound that all his dearest friends fled him, all save King Mark, Gorvenal, and Dinas of Lydon. They always could stay near his couch because their love overcame their abhorrence. At last, Tristan had himself carried into a boat apart on the shore, and lying facing the sea he awaited death, for he thought, "I must die, but it is good to see the sun, and my heart is still high. I would like to try the sea that brings all chances. I would have the sea bear me far off alone, to what land no matter, so that it heal me of my wound." He begged so long that King Mark accepted his desire. He bore him into a boat with neither sail nor oar, and Tristan wished that his harp only should be placed beside him, for sails he could not lift, nor oar ply, nor sword wield. And as a seaman on some long voyage casts to the sea a beloved companion dead, so Gorvenal pushed out to sea the boat where his dear son lay, and the sea drew him away. For 7 days and 7 nights the sea so drew him, at times to charm his grief he harped.
So we have the 7 day, 7 night thing, the one, you know, another instance of magic numbers. But we also have, I don't know if this is true, and I would be interested to know what some of you think, but it struck me as odd that he wanted to be cast adrift in the ocean. And it reminded me of kind of the Viking thing, you know, the going to Valhalla. Of course, he's not going off in a flaming boat or anything like that, but something about, you know, the wanderer and the sea, and I don't know, it's resonating interestingly with me right now. And I hadn't thought about it before until I listened to it this time. But he's definitely, this is another trial. He's already done the Moorholt. Now he's on his second trial just for this episode. Here we go.
And when at last the sea brought him near a shore where fishermen had left their port that night to fish far out, they heard as they rowed a sweet and strong and living tune that ran above the sea, and feathering their oars they listened immovable. In the first whiteness of the dawn they saw the boat at large. She went at random, and nothing seemed to live in her except the voice of the harp. But as they neared, the air grew weaker and died, and when they hailed her, Tristan's hands had fallen lifeless on the strings, though they still trembled. The fishermen took him in, and bore him back to port, to their lady who was merciful, and perhaps would heal him. It was that same port of Whitehaven where the Moorholt lay, and their lady was Isoud the Fair. She alone, being skilled in philters, could save Tristan. But she alone wished him dead. When Tristan knew himself again, for her art restored him, he knew himself to be in the land of peril. But he was yet strong to hold his own, and found good crafty words. He told a tale of how he was a seer that had taken passage on a merchant ship and sailed to Spain to learn the art of reading all the stars, of how pirates had boarded the ship, and of how, though wounded, he had fled into that boat. He was believed, nor did any of the Moorholt's men know his face again, so hardly had the poison used it. But when, after 40 days, Isoud of the Golden Hair had all but healed him, when already his limbs had recovered, and the grace of youth returned, he knew that he must escape, and he fled, and after many dangers he came again before Mark the King.
So you heard she healed him for 40 days. So we've got 40 again, which at this point is no longer, I think, is no longer a magical number reference. It's more of a biblical reference. But you also have at the end there, after many adventures, he went on to do, to go back and see King Mark. Either that means that they never had any adventures. They just wanted you to know that, of course, he is still adventuring. Or there were adventures that Joseph Bedier decided not to put in and just kind of allude to, or there's stuff that Bedier know got lost, which is my guess, actually, that he had references of other adventures that no longer are extant in the few pieces of writing that we have from the early part of the second millennia. So there we are. Now we're going to start the next one.
Part the first, the quest of the lady with the hair of gold. My lords, there were in the court of King Mark four barons, the basest of men, who hated Tristan with a hard hate, for his greatness and for the tender love the king bore him. And well I know their names, Andret, Grinnellon, Gondoin, and Deneulin. They knew that the king had intent to grow old childless, and to leave his land to Tristan. And their envy swelled, and by lies they angered the chief men of Cornwall against Tristan. They said, "There have been too many marvels in this man's life. It was marvel enough that he beat the Morholt, but by what sorcery did he try the sea alone at the point of death, or which of us, my lords, could voyage without mast or sail? They say that warlocks can. It was sure a warlock feat, and that is a warlock harp of his pours poison daily into the king's heart. See how he has bent that heart by power and chain of sorcery. He will be king yet, my lords, and you will hold your lands of a wizard." They brought over the greater part of the barons, and these pressed King Mark to take to wife some king's daughter who should give him an heir, or else they threatened to return each man into his keep and wage him war. But the king turned against them, and saw in his heart that so long as his dear nephew lived, no king's daughter should come to his bed. Then in his turn did Tristan, in his shame to be thought to serve for hire, threaten that if the king did not yield to his barons, he would himself go over sea, serve some great king. At this, King Mark made a term with his barons, and gave them 40 days to hear his decision. On the appointed day he waited alone in his chamber and sadly mused, "Where shall I find a king's daughter so fair and yet so distant that I may feign to wish her my wife?" Just then by his window that looked upon the sea, two building swallows came in quarrelling together. Then, startled, they flew out, but had let fall from their beaks a woman's hair, long and fine, and shining like a beam of light. King Mark took it, and called his barons and Tristan, and said, "To please you, lords, I will take a wife, but you must seek her whom I have chosen." "Fair lord, we wish it all," they said, "and who may she be?" "Why," said he, "she whose hair this is, nor will I take another." "And whence, lord king, comes this hair of gold? Who brought it, and from what land?" "It comes, my lords, from the lady with the hair of gold. The swallows brought it me. They know from what country it came." Then the barons saw themselves mocked and cheated, and they turned with sneers to Tristan, for they thought him to have counselled the trick. But Tristan, when he had looked on the hair of gold, remembered Isoude the Fair, and smiled and said this, "King Mark, can you not see that the doubts of these lords shame me? You have designed in vain. I will go seek the lady with the hair of gold. The search is perilous. Nevertheless, my uncle, I would once more put my body and my life into peril for you. And that your barons may know I love you loyally, I take this oath, to die on the adventure to bring back to this castle of Tintagel the queen with that fair hair." He fitted out a great ship, and loaded it with corn and wine, with honey and all manner of good things. He manned it with Gorvenal and 100 young knights of high birth, chosen among the bravest, and he clothed them in coats of homespun and in haircloth, so that they seemed merchants only. But under the deck he hid rich cloth of gold and scarlet, as for a great king's messengers. When the ship had taken the sea, the helmsman asked him, "Lord, to what land shall I steer?" "Sir," said he, "steer for Ireland, straight for Whitehaven harbour." At first Tristan made believe to the men of Whitehaven that his friends were merchants of England, come peacefully to barter. But as these strange merchants passed the day in the useless games of draughts and chess, and seemed to know dice better than the bargain price of corn, Tristan feared discovery and knew not how to pursue his quest. Now it chanced once upon the break of day that he heard a cry so terrible that one would have called it a demon's cry, nor had he ever heard a brute bellow in such wise, so awful and strange it seemed. He called a woman who passed by the harbour and said, "Tell me, lady, whence comes that voice I have heard, and hide me nothing." "My lord," said she, "I will tell you truly, it is the roar of a dragon, the most terrible and dauntless upon earth. Daily it leaves its den and stands at one of the gates of the city, nor can any come out or go in till a maiden has been given up to it, and when it has her in its claws it devours her." "Lady," said Tristan, "make no mock of me, but tell me straight, can a man born of woman kill this thing?"
I found this part kind of interesting because the whole man born of woman thing shows up again in Macbeth. Macbeth doesn't think that he's going to get nailed for any of the things because they only say that, the witches say that a man born of woman can't. Of course, Macbeth was born Caesarean section, so he wasn't actually born the right way. Just bizarre little link thing I found. But everything else so far seems to make sense. And I especially like the touch that the guys on board the ship were having a hard time pretending to be merchants.
"Fair sir and gentle," she said, "I cannot say, but this is sure. 20 knights and tried have run the venture, because the King of Ireland has published it that he will give his daughter, Isoult the Fair, to whomsoever shall kill the beast, but it has devoured them all." Tristan left the woman, and returning to his ship, armed himself in secret, and it was a fine sight to see so noble a charger and so good a knight come out from such a merchant hull. But the haven was empty of folk, for the dawn had barely broken, and none saw him as he rode to the gate, and hardly had he passed it when he met suddenly 5 men at full gallop flying towards the town. Tristan seized one by his hair as he passed, and dragged him over his mount's crupper and held him fast. "God save you, my lord," said he, "and whence does the dragon come?" And when the other had shown him by what road, he let him go. As the monster neared, he showed the head of a bear and red eyes like coals of fire and hairy tufted ears, lion's claws, a serpent's tail, and a griffin's body. Tristan charged his horse at him so strongly that, though the beast's mane stood with fright, yet he drove at the dragon. His lance struck its scales and shivered. Then Tristan drew his sword and struck at the dragon's head, but he did not so much as cut the hide. The beast felt the blow. With its claws he dragged at the shield and broke it from the arm. Then, his breast unshielded, Tristan used the sword again and struck so strongly that the air rang all round about. But in vain, for he could not wound, and meanwhile the dragon vomited from his nostrils 2 streams of loathsome flames, and Tristan's helm blackened like a cinder, and his horse stumbled and fell down and died. But Tristan, standing on his feet, thrust his sword right into the beast's jaws and split its heart in 2.
So now Tristan has gone through another one of the things that he has to endure in order to prove that he is worthy of someone as fabulous as Isolde. So now he has killed a dragon, and we're going to go on with the next bit.
Then he cut out the tongue and put it into his hose. But as the poison came against his flesh, the hero fainted and fell in the high grass that bordered the marsh around. Now the man he had stopped in flight was the seneschal of Ireland, and he desired Isoult the Fair. And though he was a coward, he had dared so far as to return with his companion secretly, and he found the dragon dead. So he cut off its head and bore it to the king and claimed the great reward. The king could credit his prowess but hardly, yet wished justice done and summoned his vassals to court, so that there, before the barony assembled, the seneschal could furnish proof of his victory won. When Isoult the Fair heard that she was to be given to this coward, first she laughed long, and then she wailed. But on the morrow, doubting some trick, she took with her Perinus, her squire, and Brangien, her maid, and all three rode unbeknownst towards the dragon's lair. And Iseult saw such a trail on the road as made her wonder, for the hoofs that made it had never been shod in her land. Then she came on the dragon, headless, and a dead horse beside him, nor was the horse harnessed in the fashion of Ireland. Some foreign man had slain the beast, but they knew not whether he still lived or no. They sought him long, Iseult and Perinus and Brangien, together, till at last Brangien saw the helm glittering in the marshy grass, and Tristan still breathed. Perinus put him on his horse and bore him secretly to the women's rooms. There Iseult told her mother the tale and left the hero with her. And as the queen unharnessed him, the dragon's tongue fell from his boot of steel. Then the queen of Ireland revived him by the virtue of an herb and said, "Stranger, I know you for the true slayer of the dragon. But our seneschal, a felon, cut off its head and claims my daughter Iseult for his wage. Will you be ready 2 days hence to give him the lie in battle?" "Queen," said he, "the time is short, but you, I think, can cure me in 2 days. Upon the dragon I conquered Iseult, and on the seneschal perhaps I shall reconquer her." Then the king brewed him strong brews, and on the morrow Iseult the Fair got him ready a bath, and anointed him with the balm her mother had conjured. And as he looked at her he thought, "So I have found the queen of the hair of gold," and he smiled as he thought it.
I think Bettier put this in just to make sure that we understood that Tristan is not in love with Iseult right now. He really is just doing this for King Mark. However, it also sets Bettier up to do this.
But Iseult, noting it, thought, "Why does he smile? Or what have I neglected of the things due to a guest? He smiles to think I have forgotten to burnish his armor." She went and drew the sword from its rich sheath, but when she saw the splinter gone and the gap in the edge, she thought of the Morholt's head. She balanced a moment in doubt. Then she went to where she kept the steel she had found in the skull, and she put it to the sword, and it fitted so that the join was hardly seen. She ran to where Tristan lay wounded, and with the sword above him she cried, "You are that Tristan of the Lyonnais, who killed the Morholt, my mother's brother, and now you shall die in your turn." Tristan strained toward the blow, but he was too weak. His wit, however, stood firm in spite of evil, and he said, "So be it, let me die. But to save yourself long memories, listen a while. King's daughter, my life is not only in your power, but is yours by right. My life is yours because you have twice returned it to me. Once, long ago, for I was the wounded harper whom you healed of the poison of the Morholt's shaft. Nor repent the healing. Were not these wounds had in fair fight? Did I kill the Morholt by treason? Had he not defied me, and was I not held to the defence of my body? And now this second time also you have saved me. It was for you I fought the beast. But let us leave these things. I would but show you how my life is your own. Then if you kill me of right for the glory of it, you may ponder for long years, praising yourself that you killed a wounded guest who had wagered his life in your gaining." Iseult replied, "I hear strange words. Why should he that killed the Morholt seek me also, his niece? Doubtless because the Morholt came for a tribute of maidens from Cornwall, so you came to boast returning that you had brought back the maiden who was nearest to him, to Cornwall, a slave." "King's daughter," said Tristan, "no. One day two swallows flew, and flew to Tintagel, and bore one hair out of all your hairs of gold, and I thought they brought me goodwill and peace, so I came to find you overseas. See here, amid the threads of gold upon my coat, your hair is sewn. The threads are tarnished, but your bright hair still shines." Iseult put down the sword, and taking up the coat of arms, she saw upon it the hair of gold, and was silent a long space, till she kissed him on the lips to prove peace, and she put rich garments over him. On the day of the baron's assembly, Tristan sent Perinus privily to his ship to summon his companions, that they should come to court, adorned as befitted the envoys of a great king. One by one the 100 knights passed into the hall, where all the barons of Ireland stood. They entered in silence, and sat all in rank together. On their scarlet and purple the gems gleamed. When the king had taken his throne, the seneschal arose to prove by witness and by arms that he had slain the dragon, and that so Iseult was won. Then Iseult bowed to her father and said, "King, I have here a man who challenges your seneschal for lies and felony. Promise that you will pardon this man all his past deeds, who stands to prove that he and none other slew the dragon, and grant him forgiveness and your peace." The king said, "I grant it." But Iseult said, "Father, first give me the kiss of peace and forgiveness, as a sign that you will give him the same." Then she found Tristan and led him before the barony, and as he came the 100 knights rose all together, and crossed their arms upon their breasts and bowed, so the Irish knew that he was their lord. But among the Irish many knew him again and cried, "Tristan of Lyonesse that slew the Morholt!" They drew their swords and clamoured for death, but Iseult cried, "King, kiss this man upon the lips as your oath was." And the king kissed him, and the clamour fell. Then Tristan showed the dragon's tongue, and offered the seneschal battle. But the seneschal looked at his face and dared not. Then Tristan said, "My lords, you have said it, and it is truth. I killed the Morholt. But I crossed the sea to offer you a good blood fine, to ransom that deed and get me quit of it. I put my body in peril of death, and rid you of the beast, and have so conquered Iseult the Fair. And having conquered her, I will bear her away on my ship. But that these lands of Cornwall and Ireland may know no more hatred, but love only, learn that King Mark, my lord, will marry her. Here stand 100 knights of high name, all who will swear with me an oath upon the relics of the holy saints, that King Mark sends you by their embassy offer of peace and of brotherhood and goodwill, and that he would by your courtesy hold Iseult as his honoured wife, and that he would have all the men of Cornwall serve her as their queen." When the lords of Ireland heard this, they acclaimed it, and the king also was content. Then, since that treaty and alliance was to be made, the king her father took Iseult by the hand and asked of Tristan that he should take an oath, to wit, that he would lead her loyally to his lord. And Tristan took that oath and swore it before the knights and the barony of Ireland assembled. Then the king put Iseult's right hand into Tristan's right hand, and Tristan held it for a space, in token of seizing for the king of Cornwall. So for the love of King Mark did Tristan conquer the queen of the Hair of Gold. End of The Quest of the Lady with the Hair of Gold.
So now we are set up for the lovey-dovey stuff, because now Tristan has to take Iseult back. I thought the language was interesting, that it wasn't just conquering the dragon, but also conquering Iseult. Although he didn't, you know, seem to do any conquering, I didn't think. But that's the language Bidier used, or at least that's how it got translated. I don't know if anybody listening has read it in the original French. I would be curious to know what the word is in the original French, because it could be kind of telling. Translation is always a tricky thing. I think I've mentioned before there's a book called Le Tombeau des Moreaux by the guy who wrote Gerdel Escherbach, Daniel Hofstadter. He wrote this book, Le Tombeau des Moreaux, which is a tome. I'm not kidding. It's enormously thick, but it's also written in like a giant font, so it doesn't hurt so much to read. And a lot of it focuses on the problems with translation, that you can translate for, if you're translating poetry, you can translate for rhyme, or you can translate for meter, or you can translate for meaning. You might be able to get away with translating for two, but you certainly can't translate for three. And he spends a lot of time with a very cute little French poem. It's, I think, 22 lines and maybe four syllables per line. It's fascinating to see how people translate it. And then he, of course, goes on and deals with things like Dante's Inferno. So, you know, if you're looking for a tome for some light fall reading, you may want to pick that up. I hope you have a great week. And next week, I can't remember if we're going to get two chapters in next week or not, but we'll give it our best shot. Have a great one. Bye. You can find a blog for this podcast at craftlit.blogspot.com or craftlit.libsyn.com. That's craftlit, C-R-A-F-T-L-I-T, all one word, and Libsyn, L-I-B-S-Y-N. And of course, you can subscribe at iTunes. Craftlit is supported by the generous donations of its listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. And do remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.